दोस्तों, आज हम आपकी मुलाकात एक ऐसे व्यक्ति से करवा रहे हैं जो एक वक्त खुद एक इस्लामिस्ट थे, लेकिन बाद में उन्होंने वो राह छोड़ दी और अब वो लोगों को काउंटर एक्सट्रीमिज्म या लोगों को कट्टरपंथ से प्रभावित होने से रोकने के प्रयासों का काम करते हैं। जी हाँ दोस्तों, हम बात कर रहे हैं पाकिस्तानी मूल के ब्रिटिशर माजिद नवाज की। 37 वर्षीय माजिद नवाज जब वो 16 वर्ष के थे तब वो हिज्ब उत तहरीर नामक इस्लामिस्ट संगठन में शामिल हुए। माजिद नवाज ने 4 साल इजिप्ट की जेल में भी काटे हैं, जहां से वो 2006 में रिहा हुए। 2007 में उन्होंने हिज्ब उत तहरीर को छोड़ दिया, जिसके बाद उन्होंने एक काउंटर एक्सट्रीमिज्म थिंक टैंक की स्थापना की, जो संभवतः दुनिया का पहला ऐसा थिंक टैंक था। माजिद नवाज की आत्मकथा रेडिकल एक बेस्ट सेलिंग किताब थी। वहीं उन्होंने पिछले साल अमरीकी न्यूरोसाइंटिस्ट सैम हैरिस के साथ मिलकर अपनी दूसरी किताब इस्लाम एंड द फ्यूचर ऑफ टॉलरेंस को ऑथर की। माजिद नवाज हाल ही में ऑस्ट्रेलिया आए हुए थे जब हमने उनसे संपर्क साधा। तो आइए दोस्तों, सुनते हैं ये बहुत ही विशेष भेंटवार्ता माजिद नवाज के साथ। यहाँ हम स्पष्ट कर दें कि इस भेंटवार्ता में जो भी विचार व्यक्त किए गए हैं वो माजिद नवाज के निजी विचार हैं। ये भेंटवार्ता अंग्रेजी में ली गई है। Majid, I want to begin by asking you that you do a lot of work in counter-radicalization, and tell us about your work. Are there really some, you know, known triggers which kind of result in people getting radicalized, and are there really any tried and tested methods to stop that radicalization?
I think it's important to recognize that there's no one route into radicalization, just as there's no one route out. But I can summarize into 4 factors for you. How somebody generally goes into this process. And the first is that the person who is in the process of radicalization usually feels a sense of grievance, whether real or perceived, and that grievance could be domestic or foreign policy issues, which leads to a level of anger and disconnect from mainstream society, otherwise known as disenfranchisement. And then the second stage that kicks in after the sense of grievance is an identity crisis, because that disenfranchisement makes the person becoming radicalized feel that they don't belong in their home society. And so they go through an identity crisis and begin wondering exactly who they are and where they do belong. And into that mix, the third factor kicks in, which is a charismatic recruiter who provides a sense of belonging to the person being radicalized by selling to them an alternative way of identity and being. And then fourth and finally, the recruiter peddles to them an ideological narrative. I call this the Islamist ideology, which then becomes the dogma through which the radicalized person views the world. So that's the 4 elements that lead to radicalization. In terms of tried and tested ways of getting people out of radical or extreme groups, I think that actually what's far more efficient is for us to focus on the preventative side of it, which is preventing young, angry Muslim teenagers or in any other context. Radicalization can occur among the neo-Nazi far right as well. So preventing any young and angry teenager going through those 4 stages in the first place, rather than trying to pull them out once they've joined, because that's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to try and get to remove the dogma from someone's mind once they've adopted it.
Majid, you have coined this word Islamism. I think you've coined this word, which you say is, you know, trying to impose some form of Islam or Islamic theology on society in whatever degree. And you said this is distinct from Islam. And you also say that, you know, Islamism is kind of, fueling a global jihadist insurgency. Now, my question to you is that why is it that it's so difficult for global leaders or, you know, other academics to confront this reality? Why is it that, you know, you are among the few people who can say it as it is?
Unfortunately, this whole debate has been clouded by an overbearing sense of political correctness, which in its extreme form leads to what we just saw unfold in Cologne in Germany, where over New Year's Eve there were mass street sex attacks against women. But because of this overbearing fear of appearing racist and in politically incorrect, there was a conspiracy of silence hatched between the police and the media, and they didn't even report this as news. It took 5 days for this news to eventually be reported. And obviously, when I say there was a conspiracy of silence, I don't mean to sound like a conspiracy theorist. The actual TV channel publicly apologized for not reporting the news as it broke. And the reason they didn't report the news is because they were petrified that they would come across as racist. So this kind of overbearing, stifling atmosphere in its most extreme form leads to not reporting facts as they are and censorship. And not only you can see how that would easily fuel the far-right narrative that only they are the ones who can suddenly become the defenders of women and suddenly become overnight feminists. And they fill the void where liberals, small-L liberals, should be the feminists talking about this when there's mass sex attacks on the street. So it's the overbearing political correctness and the fear of racism. Now, I advocate that actually if small-L liberals have this conversation where, in a sensible way, as they should be having it, they automatically deprive the far right of ammunition. And that way we don't leave that void for the conversation to be monopolized by xenophobes and bigots. And so it's really important that we begin having this conversation. And that's what I advocate for smaller liberals to do, so that we deprive others of the ability to capitalize on this and use it for their own sinister purposes.
But there might be some who might actually challenge your, say, you know, theory on Islamism. They might just, you know, challenge this entire narrative that, you know, all these groups have anything to do with Islam, really. And that, you know, that if one looks at the foreign policy of countries like America and some European countries, whether it's Syria or whether it's the second Iraq war, or if you go much earlier, you know, what they did in Afghanistan, or, you know, by dislodging Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, and, you know, many other countries. So some people might say that, no, actually, what you're saying is inaccurate, and all of this has nothing to do with, you know, Islam, the religion at all, or Islamism, as you say, and it's entirely due to political and other social economic factors.
Yeah, see, the thing is that, you know, we can't have either or. You know, it's as wrong to say that this is everything to do with Islam as it is to say this is nothing to do with Islam. The truth is, it's something to do with foreign policy, it's something to do with identity, and it's something to do with Islam. Because, look, at the end of the day, we talk about foreign policy grievances and the America and British invasion of Iraq, which, by the way, I opposed from my jail cell in Egypt. I've always been opposed to that, right? Now, if we say that's what led to extremism, then what on earth did the poor Yazidi women who ISIS enslaved en masse and rape every day have to do with any of that? They're Iraqis themselves, you know, so it doesn't add up. Or let's say the shooting of Malala Yousafzai in the head. What foreign policy mistake did she make to be shot in the head? She just wanted to go to school. So the idea that it's only foreign policy doesn't tally when we look to the victims of these terrorists and who they're killing. You know, more Muslims. Let's take Pakistan as an example, because we've just discussed Malala Yousafzai. The Taliban and other such jihadists are killing Muslims. These Pakistani Muslims didn't invade a country. They happen to be from the wrong sect, or they happen to be like Malala, who just wanted to go to school and study. So this argument that it's only about foreign policy is totally disingenuous. It's half the truth. In fact, it's a quarter of the truth, because I mentioned four factors earlier. I mentioned grievances, identity crisis, charismatic recruiters, and ideology. And we have to take a nuanced and a holistic view of this. To deal with radicalization, we have to address grievances. We have to address the identity crisis. We have to take out those charismatic recruiters. And we have to address the ideological connection, the Islamist ideology, which is an offshoot of Islam and uses Islam for justification. Let's not be in denial. Let's have this open and honest conversation, because the situation demands that.
Just one last question, Majid. You've had a long journey, and you were a former radical, and then you kind of left that way, and you know, and now you're doing tremendous work in counter-radicalization. Are you optimistic about the future, or you think we are going to see far worse times before it becomes better?
Unfortunately, I think for the meanwhile, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But I think the silver lining to this cloud is that actually people, when they look at ISIS, they realize that it's a conversation that they can no longer deny having, or deny the urgency of having. So it's become incredibly important that people are realizing that it's an agenda that requires a solution. And so I'm finding, over the course of the 8 years of my work, whereas 7-8 years ago, people would look at me with blank expressions and wonder why on earth I'm talking about the dangers of Islamist extremism, now the dangers are self-evident, and people are now asking about what the solutions are instead. So I think I have witnessed the conversation move on, and that is one of the silver linings to the dark cloud of ISIS, as I said. But this is going to be a struggle that's with us for our lifetime. It's a generational struggle. The USSR and Soviet communism, you know, Stalinism to be more precise, didn't disappear overnight. So this is a conversation that's going to happen. I think it's going to define our generation, at least. But I look forward to the future at some point where Islamist extremism becomes as unattractive as Stalinism has now become.
Majid Nawaz, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure.